The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any of the fucking amazeball content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything.
We're not doctors, not psychologists, and we're certainly not the AP. That's Associated Press for those of you listening at home. We're two non-experts who found ourselves making a little podcast that people happen to like. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. Sarah Edmondson here.
And I'm Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy, Sarah's husband, and you're listening to
A Little Bit Culty,
a.k.a. ALBC, a podcast about what happens when devotion goes to the dark side.
We've been there and back again. A little about us. True story, we met and fell in love in a cult, and then we woke up and got the hell out of Dodge.
And the whole thing was captured in the HBO docuseries, The Vow, now in its second season.
I also wrote about our experience in my memoir, Scarred, the true story of how I escaped NXIVM, the cult that bound my life.
Look at us, a couple of married podcasters who just happen to have a weekly date night where we interview experts and advocates in things like cult awareness and mind control.
Wait. This does not count toward date night, babe. We gotta schedule that. That's separate.
So it's 2 days we gotta hang out?
We do this podcast thing because we learned a lot on our exit ramp out of NXIVM. Still on that journey. And we want to pay the lessons forward with the help of other cult survivors and whistleblowers.
We know all too well that culty things happen. It happens to people every day across every walk of life. So join us each week to tackle these culty dynamics, everywhere from online dating to megachurches and multi-level marketing.
This stuff really is everywhere. The cultiverse just keeps on expanding, and so are we. Welcome to Season 5 of A Little Bit Culty, serving cult content and word salads weekly on your favorite podcast platforms. Learn more at alittlebitculty.com.
Welcome back to ALBC, everybody. We are in Vancouver recording an episode that you'll probably have in, what, 3 weeks?
In about mid-August.
Right?
And I hope that you have all had an incredible summer as we have here.
We were just reflecting this morning about how awesome our lives are right now.
Yeah.
Right? We front-loaded a bunch of episodes, got to
take a break.
Well, kind of. I mean, for the most part, we got to at least get away from our phones, have quality time with the fam.
What's been the highlight of the summer so far?
The fact that it's only rained one day since we've been here in Vancouver, and it's the day right now that we scheduled to record, which is perfect.
It's really hard if you live in Vancouver to get work done when it's sunny out during the winter months. Now that it's summer, it's been sunny every day since we got here, except for today. It's raining, and we're doing all our recording. And yeah, reflecting. It's been a great summer.
It's been great. Troy had a meltdown with the summer reading.
He did
which
not.
Which I totally relate to. I hated all that summer reading stuff.
That's the only meltdown, though. Troy said to me this weekend, "Mom, this has been such a weird but cool weekend. We went to Bowen Island for a music festival. We went to West Van and hung out at a friend's pool and swam in the ocean, jumped on the dock, like all the summer things, went to Lighthouse Park. We also biked around Stanley Park.
Yeah.
Many beach days, many kids' pool days.
Vancouver is a destination for the summer.
I don't want to
tell people here because I don't want them to come and crowd it up. But it really is. It's a great place to be during the summer because it's like one long day.
And as much as I miss our friends in Atlanta, I'm happy to not be there right now. See the reports. And also, like, Peyton sent us a picture of the snake in our front yard, the 6-foot-long black snake. So.
Honestly, reptiles will get me to move out of your area.
Note to self.
And then football starts up.
Football starts up, and yeah, we're just plugging away, enjoying summer. We've had some really fun guests over on Patreon, including John Bryant, who, as you probably know, wrote the song Cultivated, our theme song, A Little Bit Culty. What you may not know is that he was also briefly in NXIVM, and he talks about his experience in that and something else A Little Bit Culty before that, which didn't even know about until we started chatting. And that's a really fun two-parter on Patreon. And this morning, we also recorded with
Sandra Nomoto,
who was a student of a lot of different programs, including One Asian, which we have never really talked about.
Because we don't really know.
Well, we don't know because we are not Asian, Nippy and I. Big newsflash. We weren't part of that group. So we got to hear a little bit about One Asian and her journey in and out of NXIVM. And that's on
Patreon.
I think
that's going to be a good thing for people who don't want to come out,
but also know that like Patreon's a safe place.
Yeah. So. It's not totally out there in the public, but it was hard for us to find people in Vancouver to talk to that we're on good terms with, because, you know, newsflash, not everybody likes what we did. Even though they don't like Keith, they like don't like how we've handled it. That's fine. And secondly, who want to be public, be associated, who wants to be associated with a sex cult? Not everybody wants to do that.
Not a lot of people lining up for that one.
Nope. So Sandra was one of the few who were like, sure, and there'll be more of that, Sandra and John. Because as you know, most people were peripheral.
And I think it's time for your segue.
How'd you know?
Yeah, I could tell. I could see the wheels turning.
I was like, our guest today was also kind of peripheral, and not peripheral. She grew up in this cult. But when we say like hashtag I got out, the hashtag they kicked me out, different ring. And that's actually what happened to our guest. So when the Lyman family cult gave 11-year-old Guinevere Turner the boot, actually, their tactics worked. Turner was isolated from support and deprived of everything she knew in her family and community, and she even tried to get back in. But people all over the world are glad she's out because she has written quite the memoir.
Today, the acclaimed writer, director, actor has dozens of notches in her cinematic belt. But for the purpose of this particularly niche podcast, we've got American Psycho in the mind, a film she wrote in where a young Christian Bale played the fictional extreme malignant narcissist killer Patrick Bateman. It's very meme-worthy these days, the Patrick Bateman character. We're also thinking about our 2019 film, Charlie Says, about a woman who carried out murders for the ultimate culty villain, Charles Manson. Now, Guinevere Turner is telling her own story in her recently published memoir, When the World Didn't End.
I loved this book. It's on Audible. I cannot recommend it enough. Today, we dive into all the nuance. What distinguishes a Mel Lyman from a Charlie Manson? A cult from a commune? And in a culture where everything seems to be a little bit culty, who are we to say which systems of belief are right and wrong? I certainly saw a lot of parallels that made this group definitely more than a little bit culty, and we'll see what Guinevere has to say herself. Enjoy. Guinevere, welcome to this episode of A Little Bit Culty. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We know that you are on the circuit with your book coming out last week, and you got lots of interviews and your life is full. So we appreciate you taking the time with our little podcast. But this is obviously right up our alley on A Little Bit Culty.
It checks the boxes. It does.
It checks the boxes.
I mean, I want to interview you about specifically about a book and how you talk about cults and think messed up things that people have asked you. And you know what I mean? Like, we have this thing in common, which is not only our cult experience, but also the process of writing a book, the response to writing a book, how we feel about our book. I want to hear a lot about that too.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? I'm going to jump ahead a little bit and tell you that myself and three other women that we've also interviewed on the podcast, sorry, Nippy, you're invited, but you might feel a little bit excluded. I don't know.
I'm in an absorbing knowledge phase right now.
Three women who've all written about their cult experience in memoir. We were going to do an episode together, and I'm officially inviting you to the female ex-cult member memoir episode.
Oh, fabulous. You have to tell me who it is so I can read their books if I haven't already, because I've read a few.
Yes. Their books are great. One of them is Daniela Mestinic-Young, who wrote Uncultured. Mm-hmm. Do you know that book?
I do. I haven't read it, but I've listened to her being interviewed, and I follow her on Instagram where she's knitting and just talking about all kinds of things. Like, she seems amazing.
I think you're going to love her book.
She's great.
There are some parallels there.
Her story is incredible.
She's great. And also, for those of our audience who have not read your book, and oftentimes we will give your book as homework to our audience, and then they'll listen to it. And if they're good students, so they want the gold star, they'll read it and then listen to the episode. But for those who haven't yet, by the time this episode drops, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your elevator pitch now when you're doing these interviews? How do you describe who you are and how you got here?
Oh, to like a religious stranger in an elevator?
Yeah, yeah.
I am Guinevere Turner. My real life, adult life, is as a screenwriter and an actor. I've written a book about my childhood, which was, if you're listening to this, you might guess, in a cult. I was born into it, left when I was 11. And the book is about what it was like to grow up there and then what it was like to readjust to the real world and to all the bullshit that was waiting for me there. Am I supposed to not swear? Because it's hard for me.
No, no. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
I have the worst trucker mouth. I owe my son over $180 for the swear jar. So just let it rip.
She's in triple digits in that department.
And What's interesting or perhaps unique about the book is that I kept diaries very religiously. Oh, one does not say very religiously in this context. Diligently, very diligently. Yeah. And so my diaries are a big part of the book, pieces of my diaries. So in a sense, the book is co-written with my 11, 12, and 13-year-old self, which is interesting and grounding and also means that people are less likely to come for me and say, how could you remember all that? I can say, because I wrote it down when I was 10.
I love that you did.
Yeah, me too. And I love that I've been carrying around diaries from 1979 and 1980 for my whole life. I'm 55 years old.
You know, I'm in the same boat. I've got a whole like plastic Tupperware full of them, and I have not done what you did. So I think that might be my next memoir following your lead.
When you were youngin?
Yeah. Diaries and also scrapbooks. I saved like every ticket stub and like wristband from every amusement park and wrote about it.
Wow.
But I haven't gone back yet. You inspired me. I actually have something because this is super interesting that in 1971, Rolling Stone called your leader, Mal Lyman, quote, the East Coast Charles Manson. Time has shown that characterization to be inaccurate. He didn't instigate murder and he died young in 78. And yet you wrote the screenplay, Charlie Says, that features culty details pulled from your own experience. Tell us about your childhood. Like what was life like with Mal Lyman at the helm? And what do you make of that comparison?
That same journalist actually wrote a book called Mindfuckers, which is about the Lyman family and the Manson family. I'm friends with him now. His name is David Felton. My childhood, I spent a lot of time unsupervised with a lot of other kids, and those are good memories. We all sort of lived in this kind of low level of constant fear of being in trouble for big things that we didn't understand about our souls. So there was just a lot of being careful and a lot of punishment and a lot of isolation and a lot of suddenly being moved to a different place. Which would be a familiar place because, you know, we had all been to all of the places, but there was just a general instability, I would say. And people have read my book and said, it sounds so idyllic. You make it sound, you know, so wonderful. To which I say, read the whole book. Yeah. Because what happens is that at a certain point when I'm a young teenager, I start to think back on it.
Yeah.
And I start to think about some of the bad things that happened and sort of see them in a different light now that I'm older. And that's part of the journey of the book is kind of me going from longing endlessly for years, just really wanting to go back to the family, the cult that I grew up in, to slowly realizing, oh, it wasn't this magical heavenly place. And an interesting thing too is that, you know, I'm in a cult survivor discussion groups with the Lalich Center and meeting a lot of other people who have a similar experience to me. And at some point I thought to myself, can I call myself a survivor of a cult if I begged to stay? I mean, technically, does that just makes me an outcast. It just makes me a wannabe.
I think you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you can. Yeah. Because you survived. You didn't know it was bad till later. Because that's the thing that with all these things, they get normalized. All that stuff was normalized. You didn't talk about it. You didn't figure it out later that there was sexual abuse going on.
Right. And I grew up with girls who were just a little bit older than me being married off, in quotes, to men. And I was so obsessed with being an adult and being taken seriously that I wanted that too, or so I thought.
Right.
So what's interesting is that probably if my mother hadn't left and I hadn't been cast out, I would have had that to contend with. That it was an inevitability.
I thought about that. Yeah, I thought about like, obviously things were not great when you were a teenager, and we get into that shortly, but like you all were also spared from being married off at the age of 12 to an older man, right?
Yes, and I was spared from what a lot of my generation had to deal with was becoming a teenager inside of the family and either realizing you wanted to go or realizing that they wanted to go to school or like to date someone outside of the family and then having to struggle with that, you know, actually kind of fighting them. And, you know, there were people who, you know, wanted to go to college and they said, yes, you can go to college, but don't ever come back. You know, everyone of the people that I grew up with that I'm in touch with, they all say across the board, it got so much worse.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Because it started, just to give people some context, you were born in 68.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just go back a little bit to people understand the family and the communities and like, what's this group all about? What's the belief system? And we always ask our guests, like, you know, what did you think you were signing up for? Like, what was the vision? But you were born into it. You didn't sign up for it. What did your mom think she was signing up for? Like, what was she buying into? What was the promise?
Well, my mother was pregnant and had nowhere to go. Let's be clear.
Okay.
And it's 19 in 1968. You know what I mean? Like, if ever there's a time in American history anyway, where having nowhere to go, there actually are a lot of options because everybody's kind of wandering and seeking. It was 1968, but they had a free paper that they handed out on the corner called The Avatar. And she was in college in Boston at Northeastern University. And before she realized she was pregnant and her whole life was about to fall apart, she would read Avatar. And Avatar was mostly Mel Lyman's writing. She liked the ideas. And what were the ideas? I challenge anyone to read his musings and tell me. It was about, I mean, this is what I was raised with and I never understood it. And I just read as much as I could get my hands on again, writing this book. And I'm like, I still struggle to encapsulate what it was. But essentially it was this kind of, well, they were very anti being called hippies. And that's something actually that they had in common with the Manson family. They were not hippies. Kind of striving for a higher consciousness, a state of awareness, of openness, of being present. I mean, that's like Ram Dass, right? Be here now. Mm-hmm. And but it's like sort of stole from like some Christianity vibes. And like, you know, he wrote a book called Autobiography of a World Savior, if that tells you anything about his own perception of himself. And so it was kind of just be present, be honest, be truthful, be yourself. But, you know, especially when you're a kid, it's like in a given moment.
Abstract at best.
They're just abstract concepts. Yeah. We would just get in trouble for very grown up spiritual transgressions that we didn't understand.
Yeah.
I think the power dynamic depended on you not understanding it, probably, which is why it was kept abstract. It's like religion, right?
You don't get it.
They keep these somewhat nebulous terms, and all you know is that you're doing something wrong.
Right. I mean, that was what they were doing for the adults. For the kids, I have to remind myself that these people were all in their 20s when I was growing up.
Right.
People in their 20s in the 70s. Doing a lot of acid and living their lives, but also just like side note, raising children. Do you know what I mean? So I also think that a lot of what happened to me as a kid was people, adults barely paying attention, like getting mad and then forgetting about it the next day, or, you know, being like, you're not allowed to speak, go be in that closet, and then just forgetting.
Kids raising kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. While high. Yeah.
It did strike me that, especially when you were quoting Mel Lyman, we had a segment called Word Salad. Are you familiar with that term?
Yes.
Word salad. Yeah. So Nippy would like find a quote from the leader of the person that we were interviewing.
From the subject of the week and read some of their greatest hits. Got to make this somewhat funny.
Isn't that a tricky ground though? Because for some people, isn't it like kind of triggering and upsetting to poke fun at those words?
We warn them.
Honestly, every episode is cathartic for some and triggering for others. We never know what's going to happen.
A lot of tiptoeing in this space.
Yeah, but like we say it all the time, like this is where we're at. We're 6 years out. We're 6 years out of our cult experience, and we have to laugh. We have to laugh. Like that's us. If that part isn't resonating with whoever's listening, just turn it off and go to the next episode.
The title of your show would suggest that, you know, we're here with a sense of humor about something that maybe isn't like funny to everyone, but you know, a dark sense of humor is something I've been accused of having.
Well, then we're going to have fun.
Well, you're in a safe space. You're in a very safe space right now. It's impossible to be sensitive to everything, but I think we've demonstrated that, you know, with our story, you know, we've been a little bit sometimes tongue in cheek because ours is pretty dark. And it can be. So obviously we're trying to be insensitive to all that stuff, and we'll retract if people are outraged. Yeah. Doesn't happen often.
But to your point, you did a couple quotes from Mel in your book, and the whole time I was like, I have no idea what he's saying.
That's why I put those quotes in the book, because going back and reading that book is called Mirror at the End of the Road, that I'm quoting in the book, everything, every single word of it was familiar to me. And then when I was a kid, I just thought, oh, when I grow up, I will understand this. And I was like, nope.
That's the tricky thing about word salad, is because you can put stuff into it that triggers thought and you will start contemplating things, but that's just you taking what you've heard, trying to make meaning of it. And because you're thinking about it, you think it was the word salad that did it, but the word salad is just there for them to sound potentially intelligent to you and that you don't understand. Yeah. Someday you will.
I mean, it's interesting. I was writing with Sarah when you invited me onto the show about when I first started going to these discussion groups, you know, there are support groups for cult-related people. When I was a general group, so it was those of us who were raised in cults and those and people who joined and are no longer in them, I was like, I don't want to be in a group with those weirdos. I'm like, arguably, like those of us who are raised in cults are really mad at people, adults who join cults willingly. Oh, and that, yeah. You know, and maybe that's our parents. You know what I mean? That's who we're mad at.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, no, get over yourself. Like everybody, you know, deserves their journey and everybody's healing. And, mm-hmm. and I was kind of amazed at how much I had in common with people, regardless of whether or not they were raised in. But then also, we have our own discussion groups that are just for those of us who are raised in. And it's really interesting because still, you know, because one woman that is in the group, she is guilty because her dad was the leader. She's raised in, but she just got out and she's guilty because her kids are just out now and, and they're like, you know, under 10. So I was like, okay. So it's not black and white, this divide, because she is both.
Right.
Someone who raised her kids in a cult and someone who was raised, born in generations of.
Is it still in existence? Are the communities still like active?
Yes.
Like, really? Wow. And is it still called the family or the communities?
Yeah, they call themselves the communities, I guess.
Okay.
You know, most of my generation left, but a lot of those people had kids and want those kids to have relationships with their grandparents. So like the people who actually live in all those properties that I write about are not that many, but there's a lot of coming and going of my generation and the generation that they all gave birth to. I am not a parent. You're welcome, universe. Mm-hmm. And in February, Jessie, who I write about a lot in the book, who was the queen of it all when Mel Lyman died, she just died in February.
Oh, I was going to ask you about her. Yeah.
So their whole world is upside down right now. She's been the, you know, the center, the guiding force of the whole operation forever. But that comes at a nice time for me because it just means they're not paying attention to me and they won't bother with my nonsense, which might have pissed them off in a different era of their lives.
Right. Too many things to deal with. Okay, so let me backtrack for a second. So there's all these communities living this seemingly idealistic, communal, isolated lifestyle away from the real world. So there's isolation. There's this dogma around this sort of pseudo, I don't know what you call it, like pseudo-mystical kind of non-religious.
Going to Venus.
Oh, there's a belief about going to Venus.
Yes.
That's the main thing, that the spaceship's coming, taking you all to Venus. That doesn't happen in what year?
75.
Okay. And then they restart the calendar.
Yes.
I'd forgotten about that. And in your diary, you were saying 04. And I was like, wait, in 2004, she was 11? That cannot be right.
It's funny because when I was writing the book, my editor was like, are you sure you want to do this? It's confusing because we've also lived through 04 and 05. And I'm like, I have to. It's so weird. And in my childhood mind, I don't think I ever thought, oh, I'll actually be alive in the regular people 04 and 05.
What did you think about regular people when you were a kid?
World people.
Yeah.
Evil, scary, can corrupt you, don't have souls. You don't want to be around them too much. Like they're not even real people. They don't actually have a center. So you can imagine it was hard to then be told, but go live among them.
Oh, right. Yeah. And you didn't have much interaction unless there was an extreme medical emergency, like one kid chopped off their fingers. But even when your hands got burned when you were little, like they handled it internally. So you really, I mean, all the check marks, isolation from the outside world, us versus them, the grooming. Ultimately, like looking back, I'm sure you see things you obviously couldn't see as a kid, but the young women were also trained to be subservient to the men, right? Like that was their role.
Absolutely. And yeah, I was talking with my friend, Clotilde, who's in the book a lot. She was my friend growing up. At some point, she just said to me, this is just like a few months ago, she's like, did you ever wish you were a boy when you were a kid? And I was like, yeah, but not in a gender fluid way. And we just talked about the fact that when we were kids, we would all be playing, it would be fun. And then it would just be like, girls, come inside. It's time to make dinner and set up for dinner. The boys would just get to keep playing. We were like, no, we're not trans. We're just like, man, it just looks so much more fun to be a boy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The roles and the duties of the roles were clearly defined from a young age. And that was something that struck me. And I see this a lot in like with Daniela Messenick Young's book with Uncultured, Growing Up in the Children of God. And a lot of these groups that were vibrant in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and then 80s is just like the men thinking and pondering and whatever they're doing. And then the women like just running this, like there's so much to be done in an isolated community. You have to milk the cows and collect the eggs and set the table and make the food. And the kids are basically like slaves.
Yeah. Laundry was just a nonstop thing when you had that many people living together. And we also had crops, we had animals and crops. And We also just had a lot of property, like vacuuming, you know, these houses and schlepping a vacuum cleaner from one house to the next. And when I think of my childhood, I think of a lot. We were a child labor force.
Yeah, you were. You absolutely right. were. And also it makes me sad because I feel like there is something idyllic. And I talk about this a lot in the podcast. Like I am drawn to community and communal living and being with people and shared spaces and raising families together. Like that really appeals to me. And how the fuck do you do that without it turning culty? Like, I don't know.
I know. I think about that all the time because I also am drawn to that. I think it's one of the reasons I loved going to Sarah Lawrence is because it is so small that pretty soon you are walking on the campus and you notice if someone isn't from there. It's that level of once you're there for a couple years. Mm. And then I have been invited to go to these artist residencies where, you know, you're there for 6 weeks and you have a studio, but you eat dinner with all these people every night. And the first time I went to one, I was like, I love this so much. And I'm like, oh yeah, little culty bae. It's just like, I just grew up eating dinner with 45 people and it comes very naturally to me, you know? But yeah, there's no such thing as putting a group of people together in some utopian ideal without power structures and power dynamics emerging. That's the nature of humans.
This is the golden age of cult recovery. The more we speak up and share our stories, the more we realize we are not alone. Your voice and your story can empower others. This is Sarah, and I'm proud to be a founding collaborator of the hashtag #IGotOut movement. Learn more at igotout.org.
It is the nature of humans.
And it makes me sad because I want it. Like yeah. I actually get like emotional thinking about it because why can't we do it? It sucks. I don't know where that came from.
Well, you can do it. It's just there's not many hierarchies that are built that aren't vulnerable to abuses of power. There's always someone who's just going to say, hey, I'm going to take this without earning it. And that ultimately becomes kind of the catalyst for its destruction.
And then also so many men just wanting like, sorry to be vulgar, but like whipping their fucking dicks out in front of little girls. Like, can you keep it in your pants? It chaps my ass that this goes on so much. I'm enraged actually by it.
And it's just jaw-dropping. How many, I'm sure you've read and seen all the things on all the cults that have made the news. How often it all just seems like a giant ruse for adult men to have girls, you know, in some sexual context. Yeah. Luis Del Mundo is insane.
Yes.
David Koresh.
Warren Jeffs. Keith Raniere.
Yeah, even Larry Ray, you know, like that was also a much older man. Like, what is it? What is it about young femininity that men need to own? Like, what is that? Like, and how do they go to such incredible lengths to get it?
What is it?
It's staggering. I mean, and also what they're willing to risk to do it. Look at Weinstein, look at Cosby, and whatever your beliefs are on Epstein Island and all that stuff. Like, I think it's a sickness, personally.
But what it feels like to me when you say it's a sickness, Nippy, is it can give a woman the sensation that the men that aren't doing that are just restraining themselves. That's what all men want. And some men are in control enough to say, I'm not going to do that because I know it's wrong. But because it feels like when any man is given power, that's what happens. And that's through history. Like, what the F?
Yeah.
That's a fair assessment. I think what you're looking at and some of the stuff that we had conversations about in our cult is the male libido and the problems with it and what men are constantly having to restrain. I think it's something you outgrow. I mean, this is from my experience and it's a primitive impulse and I think somewhat childish if you have to indulge it all the time, if you're not building something else, if you're left to your own devices, it's probably something that's going to consume you. And I think the more you feed it, the more you want it. But I'm also not in a position of extreme power where it might be at my disposal all the time. So I'm not particularly interested in it. And I've got two kids and I've got other things that I'm building. And I think that's what happens as you get older. That's my experience, but there's plenty of evidence to suggest that's not the case. So I can tell you what it is for me. I certainly don't consider myself evolved. I think there's societal things that put it in check, but there's certain people that are always going to want to scratch that itch. And you're right.
Right. Which further makes me think, so most men would be raping all the time if they could get away with it.
I think that's the primal primitive man.
And what are we women? What primal thing are we holding back? I'm not holding back anything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a great question.
Are men more primal than women then? Are you less evolved?
Here's my thesis. I think men are less evolved in empathy, generally speaking. I don't think there's not men out there with empathy. I think if men had empathy, they wouldn't be looking at women like that all the time, because they can't picture themselves using power or force over these people to get what they want. I think that evolves. But I think there's a primal aspect to it that more conversations need to be happen around it, and there ought to be space for it so that men can say the messy, ugly things that are going on with them. And right now, they're probably feeling a little constricted. Like, I can't own and say those things. And there needs to be a safe place for that. And I think women might be holding back their primal outrage at it.
I'm not holding back right now.
You know?
I try not to hold my primal outrage back at all.
There needs to be space for that. I mean, you know, my wife was pinned down and branded with another man's initials for that reason. And you're not going to convince me it's not for any other reason. This guy wanted ownership and power over my wife, right? That's not an impulse I know or understand. I don't have that. But the impulse I have is I will stop that guy. And I think a lot of cases, men hold it back because they know there's other men that are going to stop them from doing it. Mm. You know, it's complex. It's certainly nuanced. I think the healthy conversations should probably start with what are natural inclinations as men and women. What primal forces are informing our behaviors? Get sensitive to those and then start from there.
Me too.
I'm resistant to essentializing gender in that way and to saying that men are, if we all can understand that men are like this and women are like this. I mean, yeah. Aside from gender fluidity and the spectrum of gender identity, it gets very dangerous when we talk about biological imperative, I guess.
I've got to say, I feel totally the same way. And it reminds me of what we were doing in Nexium, which was we thought we were doing that. Like, we thought we were like looking at the extremes so we could understand it and like evolve better and like raise our consciousness. Like, it triggers me in a way. And I don't even want to use the word trigger, because that's a trigger. Like, it's just upsetting. I agree with you, Nippy. Like, I want to be able to get all this out in the open. I guess that's part of the reason why we're doing this podcast. And yet every single story, almost, not every single one, but most of them has this at the root of it. And I feel like when we start going, well, men tend to do this one, like, I know where you're coming from and that's a good intention. I feel like it makes the divide more. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, I don't have a solution, actually.
Having a conversation about it makes a divide more than we need to evolve how we're having the conversations. There are tendencies, but I think in the extremes is where it gets abusive.
Oh, and the thing is that, you know, I'm devil's advocating you a bit, Nippy, because part of me is like, why the fuck are men like this?
Me too.
You know, like, I'm guilty of essentializing men versus women. And, you know, who are serial killers predominantly? Who are all the predators? Like, women are such a small percentage of, you know, in all of those categories of, you know, people who are violent and horrible to other people, predominantly women. So it's like, on the one hand, there's just the scientific evidence, like, whatever it is, men are just more fucked up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is it just because you're all physically stronger? It just started there. That's so basic. I want us to be more evolved than that.
Well, you have hormones that we don't have.
That's a great place to start. I can answer just from my experience, like, growing up primarily what I would call jock culture, which is something I later on as an adult had a major aversion to, because the world's not a locker room. Mm. And I felt like I outgrew it. I was like, okay, got it, you know, whatever. But there's always a pecking order and there's always a tacit hierarchy amongst, I don't even call them alphas, I mean, these labels, but like amongst men. And it's kind of tacitly understood or not. And there's kind of a hierarchy. And why I think men tend to do that is something that the conversation, it's another podcast.
Can I add something to this that I'm just putting together?
Yeah.
You know, I read your book. We've done one on Warren Jasper. All the people you just mentioned, Luz del Mundo, all these incredibly dark stories. And almost every single leader that we've looked at, I don't know much about Mel Lyman, and you can fill me in if you want. Keith Raniere, David Koresh, almost all of these guys were like super low self-esteem, either outcasts or nerds or like
mommy issues too.
Mostly mommy issues, like didn't feel loved by their mom, found some skill that they were really good at, whether it's playing guitar or like pontificating or whatever.
Or manipulating people.
And then they like created a little circle around them and then grew and made themselves the leader in this hierarchy. And then at some point started making it okay to have sex with 12-year-olds, you know, based on this premise of like, they had a direct line to God. Like, God said, you know, I'm supposed to have sex with this young girl or whatever. But like, it just feels like there's just from the narcissistic wound or whatever, like we talked about with Dan Shaw, remember, Nippy? Like, they just feel like worthless and nothing. And it means something about them that they get to have this beautiful, nubile, young, perfect specimen of a woman. Teenage girls are beautiful. Like, so that means something about them that they can acquire it and have it and do what they want with them. It fills that wound in a way that it's hard to understand. Does that resonate? Does Mel Lyman fit that profile?
You know, what's so interesting about how I grew up is that I never had the opportunity to ask anyone why they joined and what he was like before, because I'm just a kid. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I've never had an adult conversation with anyone about what he was really like. You know, he was just our Lord and Savior, and he was all about his music. But how he transitioned from being a folk musician mm-hmm. to being a cult leader, it happened before I was born. And so I have no idea what got him there. But, you know, he did have a 13-year-old as a quote-unquote wife. That was the daughter of his best friend, who also had a 13-year-old girl as a wife, blah, blah, blah. So wherever it came from, it ended up in that same place. I guess Manson is a little different because he wasn't a pedophile, but he definitely was older than the women that he was manipulating. It seems like he was more... I mean, he wanted to have sex with all of them, but he wasn't mm-hmm. he wasn't going all the way to under 18. Mm-hmm. And you know who's an exception to this rule and an exception to a lot of the sort of like standard fare template of cults
yep.
is Heaven's Gate and Martin T and Doe, because they were like, don't have sex and desexualize yourself. And when that all came out in the 90s, I was like, hey, points for cult originality. Yeah.
The asexuality.
You know what I mean? Like, you surprised me. Yeah. Like, that's nice. You know, everybody else is just like, I mean, I remember when Waco happened, I was watching it unfold for all like 50 days, whatever. And I was like, do they not fucking understand? Mm. You right. do not confront right. an apocalyptic cult.
Yep.
They're gonna fucking kill themselves.
Right.
Everything that their leader said is now happening. Now you've given them a platform and a reason to live. And I was like watching it happen, and I was like, they need someone there who understands these dynamics. I just watched the most recent piece about Waco. It's so heartbreaking.
Devastating.
It's so heartbreaking what actually happened. You haven't watched it?
No, because I remember when I watched the series, like the scripted series on it. It was too upsetting. And with the children there, it derailed me.
Yeah.
They did a second part of the scripted series, which goes back a lot. And it's like the trial and stuff. And yeah, I just watched that too. And you know how I'm sure you both have this, where some days you're like, yeah, cults, I'm going to get into it. Yeah. Some days you're like, yeah. I can't with the C word. I can't, like, it's too emotional. It's too devastating. I am more than a cult person. I'm going to go read about something that has nothing to do with any of this.
Yes.
Sometimes you feel strong. Or for me, I just feel like I need to know, because I'm constantly talking about cults. And because it's, for me, I'm sort of slowly trying to formulate what needs to happen in the laws, in the cultural consciousness, what needs to happen to chip away at this and to make it not something that could happen to people, or at the very least that people can see, so that if it's happening to someone, you know, you have tools to help them out of it. If it's happening to you, you've heard enough about what that looks like, so you're not as likely to get sucked in. Because this is kind of a mission of mine, I'm just looking at all of it. And people always say, like, that could never be me. That could never be me. And I need an answer for that. And I am trying to find the perfect soundbite to say to someone who thinks they're better than you guys, or thinks they're better than all the people we see on all the documentaries, to say, like, you just don't fucking know till you know.
Hey there, listener. Hope you're enjoying this episode and that you're taking deep breaths when we cover the enraging stuff that cult jerks are up to. Let it out is in the yoga practice. Inhale positivity, exhale negativity. That's for you, Sarah. We got this. No hulking it out, all you little hulksters. And if you need some helpful resources on the topic of cult recovery, check out our website at alittlebitculty.com. And now, here's a brief message from our sponsors.
We have a soundbite. And just so you know, we're on the same mission. We're exactly on the same mission. We could start a little club, but it won't be culty. There'll be no power dynamics or hierarchies. This is something I'm very passionate about, and putting it into sound bites that, like, normal people understand who aren't going to watch a whole series on Waco or whatever, or read your book, which they should. But if they're not, here's a little soundbite.
If you're the kind of person that doesn't think it would happen to you, in a lot of ways, you're the most susceptible, because you're not going to recognize the symptoms and precursors that get you into it, because you don't think you're susceptible to it. And if you were someone who didn't think you're susceptible to it, and I was a cult leader, I'd target you.
That's our soundbite.
That's pretty much how it is.
Yeah.
The other thing too, in hearing your story, you know, one of the things to prevent that kind of how could you fall for it, all that stuff, which is, you know, ultimately in reconciling our delusion around this, it's like I had to ask myself those questions and go eat my humble pie and do that work. And ultimately what I've come to the conclusion is the abuses of power that go inside these cults, so to speak, are very akin to the abuses of power that go into our culture. And there's a lot in our culture that have just been normalized that have kind of culty feels to it, hence a little bit culty. So I think how you can make your story, our story, wisdom is the extremes of these abuse of power that become so obvious to the outside world. If you can start recognizing that those abuses are going on in our culture, they just don't look as bad and they've been normalized. And the quote I took from, I think, New Yorker interview is, you said something, popularity and longevity can do a lot to render odd convictions reassuringly familiar.
You are a genius.
Yeah. Well, I read that and I was like, of course, we walk around in our current culture and society and a lot of these things are reinforced, but they haven't been evolved. That creates culture wars in a sense. So it's a process of self-awareness. And I have another podcast and oddly a football coach said this. He's like, I'm determined to not be a part of the division. And be a part of the unification of it. And I just have to check myself in being that and just make sure I'm not going to be a part of that. And I think that's, for me, just like a motto I have right now and going forward. But that line just popped out to me because I think the cults are informative to us if we can take the wisdom out of them and look in our current society and go, there it is, there, there it is, there it is.
Yeah.
And then ultimately have legislation that's sensitive to it.
Yes.
And mental health professionals who are trained specifically in this arena, which is, I know from personal experience, not very few, and very few who are survivors themselves. And that's one of the many things, like in these discussion groups at the Lalich Center, I taught a writing workshop to some of the women in the group, which was amazing. And one told me that a therapist had said to her, you know, why don't you start by, you know, writing stuff down? And what she said, she totally shut down because, you know, part of her cult experience was that having to write to the leader all the time. And so writing had kind of turned into this really upsetting, like stress-filled thing. And I'm like, that's so basic. Ask your little culty patient, what does writing feel like to you? And understand that someone who's really fresh out might not even be able to answer such direct questions like what makes them feel okay or not. You know, like really basic things. I feel like I could be a great therapist and I have no training as such because I just really understand like that your first instinct is going to be to say that you're fine.
Right.
You know, that you're being selfish by even being in therapy. You know, that you're being self-involved, that like you're on your own trip. And so that's another thing. And it's just been so life-changing to even be in a room with people like me. I tried really hard to find that, you know, IRL. These are some silver linings of COVID, I like to call them. One of them is just that actually communities like this, cult survivors, can be together from all over the world on Zoom. And that's been something that people are now, they can do. So that's a silver lining of COVID, right?
Yes, there were actually a lot for us.
To me, going to therapy felt more indulgence of my internal world, which I had done.
Yeah, because NXIVM was a therapy-based cult.
Yeah. And so like I was going right back to the scene of the crime to fix the scene. Do you know what I mean? And I was just like, I can't sit here. This is like, and I wasn't self-aware enough at the time to know that's what was going on. I knew I didn't have a therapist that was going to figure that out.
We struggled there as well. And I think also just as a positive note, that's changed in the last 5-6 years since we've been out. Largely because there's so many documentaries and podcasts and it's like the new, you know, golden age of cult awareness. And there's a lot of people who have written to us saying like they were in school and they went in this direction to be a cult expert, like a trained therapist or studying with Yanya Lalich. And we were big advocates on the Lalich Center because Yanya's book, Take Back Your Life,
her book was
like crucial for
so good
for our healing. Do you know that I narrated her book too, by the way, sidebar?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. Because when I read her book, I was like so fresh out. I had a trouble sitting and reading. Like I was too agitated. And I said to Yanya, I'm like, please put this on Audible. Please put this on Audible. And I was like, I'll do it. Like, let me do it because I tell people all the time to read it. And some people can't read it. Some people just can't read afterwards.
You mean there's the kind of people who don't have that kind of focus or whatever?
Or I just see a lot of cult survivors have a hard time picking up a book and reading. Like they're too in hypervigilance. They're too much PTSD. There's too much like stress to just chill the fuck out and read a book. I listen and walk, you know. I still, like, I listen to your book at 1.75 speed.
So did I sound squeaky?
You didn't sound squeaky, but you definitely speak very fast. But that's how my brain works, so I can catch up with you. So it was great. It was great for me.
I mean, the thing is, I already kind of talk fast. I had to really train myself to, you know, to slow down when I was reading.
Sarah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, that was a really good impression.
1.75 there.
Your book is so good. And the thing that I really love about it, because of your journals and because of your writing expertise, I get blown away time and time again with these cult memoirs where you're writing about your childhood. The way that you were able to explain, like the way you talk about like static and what's happening internally when these things are going on externally and how you dealt with it and how the explanation of your coping strategies to deal with what you were seeing around you to survive was, I think, would be really healing and cathartic for other survivors to read your book, to feel like less alone.
I mean, essentially, it's just dissociation, and I didn't have a name yes. for it, right? But it, essentially, it's just kind of like, I don't want to be here anymore, so I'm kind of not.
Yeah, but the way that you describe it, and it's interesting because every person who has a similar experience like you describes it differently, and yet I can totally imagine it. You know, like there's different mm-hmm. metaphors for it. Like you describe it as the static and like the voice far away saying like, help, now's the time to say something. And you, and the voice is like disappearing farther and farther away. And you're like, oh, no, get that voice. But like going, no, stay there. Say it, say it, say it. Oh, I'm just rooting for you.
Yeah.
Normally in the podcast, and I derailed on the pedophile rant.
We've lost the plot.
Normally we share like you were in this thing, but you got kicked out. You got kicked out because your mother left. And so you had to go be with your mother and you didn't want to leave. I'm summarizing. And again, we're going to recommend people read the book. But what was interesting to me is that you left the cult, you wanted to go back and you were stuck in this situation with your stepfather. And I'm wondering, when did you realize that you were, the family and the communities were a cult? And when did you make the correlation between getting out of the cult and then getting into another culty or abusive situation?
I knew almost immediately that I call him FP in the book. That's not his real name, but not because I'm protecting him, but because I just didn't want to look at his name over and over and say it over and over. And I just want you to know, so I call him FP. That stands for fucking psycho. And that's just a little present to myself. Because then I get to say this over and over.
I was wondering about that. I actually had that premonition that you were going to say that it was an acronym.
That it stood for fucking psycho?
No, not that one, but there was an acronym for you. It meant something to you. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
Good for you, that fucking psycho. He is a fucking psycho.
So I immediately saw that his main motivation for leaving was that he didn't have enough power and that he was going to not only have that power that he wasn't allowed, you know, he wasn't powerful enough to have a child bride, you know, but he was still spewing their doctrine, his version of it, which was even more mind-numbingly gibberish. And, you know, framed photographs of the leader on the wall and preserving the way that they dealt with daylight savings time, which was, you know, at some point it's world time and our time because we didn't observe daylight savings time because whatever. And so I knew, I could immediately see that he was having his own little cult and treating my mother the same way. My mother was acting the same way. So, but in that case, I just thought like, how dare he try to be like them? He's not them. He could never hold a candle to them. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I wasn't like, you know, oh no, it's the same fucked up way I grew up. I'm just like, you can't, you're not powerful enough to pull this off. So it's a really, really complicated kind of journey mm-hmm. of figuring out where I came from. And then honestly, so I just stopped talking about it as soon as I realized that I went from eighth grade where everybody saw me come in as the total weirdo to high school, which was a different school with more people. And I was like, okay, erase cult. But I called it a commune and then I didn't call it anything. I lied about how I grew up because I just was like, I can't, I need to put this away. And I still didn't think of it as a cult until I was 22. And like most times that I've gone to therapy, they're relationship mandated, i.e. in which the person says, if you don't go to therapy, I'm going to have to break up with you. Ha, therapy's hilarious. And so this first woman therapist that I went to, she listened to me. And then she said, you know, that's not a commune you grew up in. It's a cult. And I was like, rude.
How rude. How dare you?
Rude. And then she gave me the Cult Awareness Network newsletter, which, you know, this is pre-internet, this story, it's the early 90s. And I read the newsletter and I was like, God, these people are, they don't know anything about cults. I just think that like everyone's a cult and they're just like out to bust them. It's so generic. It's so broad strokes. It took me another 6 months basically to realize, oh no, I did grow up in a cult and a lot of people are in cults and there's a pattern. I mean, I'm out here writing a term paper about Jim Jones when I'm 12 and being like, what a bunch of weirdos. Like I was just circling it mm-hmm. without seeing myself. It's so weird. I mean, the thing about me is like, I also asked my mom when I was 13, like, what would you do if I turned out to be gay? I didn't think I was gay. I was just like, wow, people are really rude to gay people. Like, why? And so I asked my mom that and she was like, I would think I'd done something seriously wrong with your upbringing.
Oh.
And even then I was like, God, like my mom has a Greenpeace sticker, but she's so mean about gay people. Like poor gay people. Anyway, my point is that things can circle around me for a long time before I realize I'm talking about myself.
Right.
Well, Sarah and I joked when we got out, we would look at other groups and go, that's a cult. Like all the time. Meanwhile, we're in our situation, which is for sure a cult, But we were like sanctimonious about it. Right, Sarah? Remember? Yeah. We were like, that's a little culty. And like,
I'm sort of fascinated by how the new cult space, things that morph into cults are things that are just at least coercive control in some way, even if you're not living in an isolated compound, are a lot in the self-help space, the acting teacher turned life coach space, and in the cult recovery space.
Yeah.
And it's women. Mm-hmm. It's like, yay, empowerment. Women are now becoming the also as good at being dangerous predators, not in the way that men are and have traditionally been, but it does seem like a lot of women are now the coercive control perpetrators.
Yep.
Which I'm like, wow. And in LA, there's a never-ending influx of idealistic people from elsewhere who really want to make it in Hollywood. Like, what a fertile ground for cultiness and coercion.
This podcast is brought to you by Citizens of Sound, a podcast production agency committed to developing and launching shows with gravity and depth. From conception to launch, Citizens will partner with you every step of the way, whether you're an actor, business owner, doctor, fitness coach, hairstylist, or influencer. Connection is the future of communication. Jump on board with Citizens of Sound today and start your show. Go to citizensofsound.com and follow them on Instagram. And trust me, it'll be a really good decision for you.
That was the end of part one. Stay tuned next week for part two with Guinevere Turner. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know I won't.
Hope you liked this episode. Let's keep the conversation going and come hang out with us on Patreon, where we keep the tape rolling each week with special episodes just for Patreon subscribers and where we get deep into the weeds of unpacking every episode of The Vow.
And if you're looking for our show notes or some sweet, sweet swag or official ALBC podcast merch or a list of our most recommended cult recovery resources, visit our website at alittlebitculty.com.
And for more background on what brought us here, check out Sarah's page-turning memoir. It's called Scarred: True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life. It's available on Amazon, Audible, narrated by my wife, and at most bookstores.
A Little Bit Culty is a Talkhouse podcast and a Trace 120 production. We're executive produced by Sarah Edmondson and Anthony Nippy Ames, with writing, research, and additional production support by senior producer Jess Tardy. We're edited, mixed, and mastered by our rocking producer, Will Rutherford of Citizens of Sound. And our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Aslan. Thank you for listening.